Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and I'm delighted to be with, once again, one of my favorite people and authors, Michael Carita. But this time, I'm with Michael Carita, writing as Scott Carson, a whole new identity. So what's up with Scott Carson?
Scott was gravely ill. He couldn't be here today. He sent me to represent him, and that's what I will be doing. I'll play that bit out for about another 3 years until people get really tired of it. Scott Carson is, in all seriousness, going to take over the dark side, the supernatural, the weird, the woo. Call it whatever you would like. I'm very curious to get your opinion on this, because we have had only minimal exchanges about the idea of the pseudonym. But you have valiantly fought to hand sell my books for lo these many years, and it is so appreciated. But you've seen the fans who will read anything by a writer who they like. There are the fans who only want a PI novel, or they only want supernatural. And there's it's kind of like a canyon they won't cross. So I'm curious to hear from you whether you think this is a good idea to pass the supernatural baton over to Scott Carson, or am I making a terrible, terrible mistake?
Well, it's way too early to tell, Michael, and I don't think that you could ever say that anything creative that you try is a terrible mistake. If it doesn't work, that doesn't mean it was a mistake.
Absolutely.
I think it's a valiant effort, and, you know, I could go back and talk about two people who have done what you have done, both very esteemed authors, Ruth Rendell, who wrote more conventional crime with Inspector Wexford and other things as Ruth Rendell, and then she wrote her more gothic novels as Barbara Vine. And that distinction worked really well, although fans knew that Ruth Rendell was Barbara Vine. Nonetheless, the brands were different. Elizabeth Peters did the same thing. She wrote mystery, particularly the Amelia Peabody series, which I absolutely adore, and which I reread in December in Egypt with Dana Stabenow. She wrote those as Elizabeth Peters, but she wrote another series as Barbara Michaels, and many of them were ghost stories or, you know, historical really witches, hauntings, and so forth. And I think that that distinction worked very well for her fans. So,
one of my inspiration points for this would be Donald Westlake, who I'm a big fan of Richard Stark.
Right.
The Donald Westlake stuff never really worked for me on the same level that the Stark novels did. But if you go back to, any BoucherCon, any convention over the years, you have the Stark fans, the Westlake fans, and you have a debate created about that. Then you have the people who love both. So it seemed like something. I've been doing this is my 15th book, so I've been doing this for a little while now, and it seemed like a way to try something different creatively, get a little bit of a different energy, and hopefully it pays off and we have two successful brands there. But in the meantime, it was great fun to mentally be able to step back and feel almost like a debut writer again. You know, you can't completely recapture the lovely, naive, blissful moment of that. But I came closer than I thought I would have been able to, actually.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, you know, you started writing PI novels and were hugely successful with, what were there, 5, 6? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, there were 4 in the Lincoln Perry series, and then I did 2 with Marcus Novak.
Right.
And 5 with St. Martin's, yes.
And that's a fairly well-known format. You know, people who like PI novels have certain expectations when they come to them, you know, that the private eye, you know, that's his job, and he gets a client, and, you know, he's either working it for money or whatever it is, and he pursues an investigation.
And you can't kill him.
No. And, you know, we have the Robert Parker template and all kinds of other templates for private eyes. And I do think that people who like those, they're comfortable with them. But then you've written a number of gothic novels, the one in French Lick, wasn't it, with that beautiful hotel?
Yeah, So Cold the River. Which
wasn't that the first one, I think, you did that was, right. So, and then another one in Florida, and, you know, even your last one with the electrician and so forth, there were a certain amount of... by the way, I tried to get it. I meant to tell you that for tonight, but it doesn't come out for another 10 days. So the paperback.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So
we're
I gave it a shot, yes. But I couldn't do it. Anyway, I'm thinking of a conversation I had with Janet Ivanovich. We launched her book in November of 2019, her 26th Stephanie Plum. And they've all been more or less up to readers' expectations. You know, they have the title by the number. We have Stephanie. We have Joe. We have Ranger. There might be a third guy in it. And now, Janet, part of our conversation, she's dropping the numbers. She's sending Stephanie off in a new direction, new titles, you know, new concept and all. But she's very clear that readers have what she calls expectations for a Janet Ivanovich novel. And she feels, you know, that she knows what they are. And even if she's going to change up the packaging and so forth, that readers will still expect those things from her, although they may be a little more adventure, you know, maybe less emphasis on will she or won't she with the guys, maybe, you know, slightly different direction. Nonetheless, the package should be that. So I think you're right that people do have expectations for a brand. You know, they pick up a CJ box, they know they're going to be in Wyoming, they know it's going to be Joe, you know, up against forces of nature and human nature and, you know, and the climate, and bad things will happen, but Joe will weather his way through it, and Nate will pick up maybe some of the bad stuff, and on and on. But he also writes another series, and which is quite different, and interestingly, that's the one that has sold to television, the one about Cassie. And Cassie has become a private eye and now working in Montana, so she's had this kind of journey now, and it's becoming a brand, and with television it'll probably be becoming more of a brand. So there's no reason why, looking at all this, why you can't do this too.
No, and you don't want to create reader confusion.
Right.
And as much as I would love to imagine that TV and film doesn't affect it, we obviously know that it does. So I have movies coming out that are within the Karita brand of mainstream thriller. And it's been, this shocks me, but it has been 10 years since I last wrote anything overtly supernatural. So in terms of trying to give your publisher the best assist possible and the booksellers the best assist possible, it felt like the right time to try this from a variety of perspectives. But one of those being, you know, let's take all of the advantages we can to create that brand, create that clarity. And then the other element is just, it's a story that really excited me. As you know, possibly to your chagrin at times, I'm committed to, I chase the story that excites me. And this one just, it needed to be a ghost story. I loved the idea of having, you're going to laugh at me, but I loved the idea of having a name that people could spell and pronounce based on just hearing it.
You mean Carson as opposed to Karita?
Carson as opposed to Karita, yes. I've heard Cortilla, Karupa, Coriatada. Mm-hmm. There was one really awkward, it was my own mistake, one really awkward night in the Miami area, Fort Lauderdale, where they do sort of a Friends of the Library gathering. And I'm at this gentleman's opulent, extravagant home, and he's hosting the event, and the kind of MC, for lack of a better term, said, I'd like everyone to give a round of applause to the person who we're all here for tonight, and his first name was Michael, and then the last name was close enough to Karita that I thought they had introduced me, so I stood up and waved while this guy stood up behind me, who actually owned the home, and took the applause that he was due. So Carson feels very innocent to me.
I can see that. You've heard John Lesquire's wonderful story, haven't you? Because he has one of the toughest names at all.
What he has been through, I can't even
imagine. Well, Lesquart, so it's Lesquire. But he tells a wonderful story about an event that he went to at a Barnes & Noble, wherever it was, California, I imagine. And when he got there, was early in his career, so he didn't expect it. They were so thrilled to see him, and they made this huge fuss. And they took him over a table. It was absolutely piled high with books, and he thought, wow, this is so terrific. And then he looked down, and he realized they were all by John Le Carre.
I've lived this.
Yes, the bookstore thought, surely, you know, this was going to be Le Carre. But here's the good news.
Michael Crichton confused at the L.A. Times Book Festival.
Oh, yeah?
In 2008, yes. I approached the line and seen this massive line going back from my tent. I had this moment of, like, oh, my God, man, this is the turning point, and it will forever be embedded in my mind. It is this abrupt and iconic of a moment where you go from 5 people to, you know, 50, 500. And apparently there had been some confusion based on the pronunciation of my name, and people thought Crichton was in the building. So very quickly my crowd dissipated, and my Michael Crichton signatures never came to pass. But, yeah, I've lived that. It's an ideal humbling experience.
Well, aside from the Carson thing, here's the other really good news for you. And I think waiting to do this is in your favor. There is all of a sudden a huge rise in the Gothic, the ghost story, and the supernatural. It's like a tidal wave coming up. And I've been, every other book I'm getting from in advanced reader copy form, the copy has said, you know, Gothic. Or in the British crime classics that we publish, some of them are Gothic. Martin Edwards has written, too, the sequel to, I'm trying to remember the first one, Gallows Court. And then the UK is really trumpeting the sequel, Mortmain Hall, as a Golden Age Gothic. Golden Age Gothic is actually becoming a thing, as well as Gothic. And I've been trying to figure out why the interest. And I think there are two reasons. One, I think we've gotten to a new generation of readers, because mystery really peaked at the end of the 90s, and it kind of fell into a trough, as genre fiction does. And it takes about 20 years for a genre to crash and then come up again, and that's because it needs a new generation of readers. So what we have all of a sudden is editors, reviewers, booksellers, and readers who really don't know the crime classics. You know, they're not well grounded in it. And I was thinking about Peter Swanson's book for this March called 8 Perfect Murders, in which he, you know, lists 8 of them. But the thing that really interests me, and I won't say what it is as a spoiler, is that for me, on page 2, it was perfectly obvious that the 9th book, the one that you would expect to be there, was in fact what the book was, and the other 8 were just a ticket to it. And I thought, okay, but if you don't know the basics, if you don't know the classics, you would not recognize what he's doing.
Right.
Okay? So part of that, I think, is an interest in older books where there were more Gothic elements. The other part is I think it's a natural progression from Trust No One. I think all of this domestic suspense and Trust No One, where you have, you know, all of that going on, I'm finding it beyond boring at this point, because, you know, I'm so saturated in it.
Yes.
But I also think that it has taken us from more straight line mysteries like the Private Eye novel and moved us into that area of the Gothic where you can't trust anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, a really great Gothic demands a house or a castle, or in your case, Tunnel 3 in the New York subway system, water system. But nonetheless, I think that things are converging in a way that you're doing this just at the right moment.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. And I wouldn't disagree with anything you said. I also would throw out, I think the political moment does help give the rise to supernatural or Gothic fiction.
Well, we all feel like we're living in a Gothic world.
Yes, and you take comfort in imaginary monsters. There's something about, I would rather read about a ghost than anything that I feel like could be taken from the headlines. And I feel that push-pull. So the chill is really, it is inspired from the headlines in a very literal way with the water system threat. But the refreshing quality, the energy and pure escape of going back to a ghost story felt really good after 3 years of being bludgeoned with tweets and news coverage of tweets and
all the false information and, you know, fake news and the rest of it. I agree. I think the real world is hard to inhabit at the moment. We've made a
Absolutely.
Serious
well
effort
said.
To remain an apolitical environment. We want our customers to come down here at night and have great conversations with authors and not have to deal with all of that, because, you know, it's our daily life. And it's been very successful for us. We're a commercial fiction bookstore at the Poison Pen. We are not a political bookstore, and that was a doesn't mean that we don't feel passionately political, but we don't run it. We don't run that current through our business.
Right, and I would think your customers on both sides still feel the fatigue, regardless of.
I imagine they do, but you know, it was just the decision we made in 2016 that, you know, we were going to provide escape, a harbor, a refuge, and a place to discuss ideas and books without controversy, and everybody would remain civil. And so far, we've been able to do that. So I don't generally introduce that topic, you know, into our conversations. But I think you're right in terms of what people are prepared to read at the moment, that it's inspired by the real world as well as the fictional world. So I think there are a lot of things coming together. If I were younger and if I really wanted to go back and do a doctorate, which I've often thought about since I've done master's degrees and all, that would be the subject that I would write. I would write about a genre churn in fiction. Why is it that, you know, science fiction goes up and crime goes down?
Right.
When I opened the store in 1989, historical fiction was completely dead. And it had been tremendous in the 70s and the early 80s. You know, you had guys like Samuel Shellabarger, and you had, you know, Lloyd Douglas, and you had all this other stuff going on. And that's why there was this huge amount of historical mystery in the 90s, because you had Umberto Eco, you had Alice Peters starting her series,
sure.
and you had all kinds of people who had written historical fiction suddenly coming in with a mystery plot in order to keep going. And now there's not much in the way of historical mystery, but there's a huge amount of World War II and women's fiction that is inspired, you know, historical fiction again, well, less of it in crime. And I do think a lot of it has to do with reader fatigue and what's going on in the world, and a lot of it just has to do with a new audience coming up that is basically virgin, you know,
sure.
to the genre.
Hey, you've been saturated with, as you say, that, you know, domestic suspense, even if you've loved those books, at some point
you want to read
feel
something
like,
else.
Hey, I've read, exactly, I just need to move on.
It was like
What's
all the Da Vinci
thing?
Clones. I'm telling you,
yes.
for like 3 years after the Da Vinci Code, every book I got was a religious conspiracy thriller. I called them Da Vinci clones, you know, and then eventually it kind of wore itself out. And also, I think it's also helped by the fact, the wearing out part of that process is there's so many people that rush into it, and a lot of the books really are not of quality. And so you not only get super saturated, but you get a lot of not very good books, and the combination kind of tips people over, you know, in a new way. So let's talk a little bit about The Chill, because I think it's fascinating. You set us up in a small community in upstate New York, but it's a crucial part of the water system that feeds New York City from the mountains, so you have a lake. And then you come down. Now, years ago, I don't remember how long ago, Linda Fairstein wrote a terrific book called Bad Blood, in which the whole crime, the whole deal for her prosecutor, went down in tunnel number 3. So I'd already been there and read about it. So
this would have been back in the early days of the construction. How long ago was that book?
I looked it up. I think she wrote it in the early 2000s, and I do think maybe it was still under construction. It's been a long time since I've read it.
Yeah,
but
it still is now. So.
But I did think it was, that's when I learned about where New York gets its water. And that's the great thing about reading mystery. You learn all this cool stuff that, you know,
right.
you wouldn't normally ever run across.
We're sneaking an education past people.
Totally. I mean, I read it, you know, for plot and for character and all, but I also read crime for information, and you want to trust your authors that they're doing a good job with it. Anyhow, I have been in Tunnel 3, so to speak, with Linda.
Right.
So I really enjoy going back there with you. Your treatments couldn't possibly be any different, you know, which is another great thing about crime is you can have the same geographical location, the same space, and yet you can have two stories do completely different things within that space.
Right. James Ellroy's Los Angeles and Michael Connelly's Los Angeles are very, very different approaches. I was just so fascinated by the idea of a city of that scope and grandeur and importance, global importance, being fed by such limited and antiquated infrastructure. And then also the idea of, I mean, when you talk about a Gothic idea, these little mountain towns that had existed for generations being flooded off the map, but they're never really gone. They had their history, they had their culture, they have their families, they have their legends. And so to me, that becomes a story that bridges eras now. And for whatever reason, when I'm drawn toward the supernatural, it's usually a story that's grounded in the natural world. It's the hurricane in the Cypress House, the sulfur springs, and so cold the river. There's something about that that tilts me toward the ghost story. And I think it's because of the question of, you know, how did this come to pass and at what cost? Who was left behind? What are the forgotten stories? And then the past is suddenly very much in the present of the book. And when I have that, you know, I'm off to the races at that point.
Yeah, reservoirs are a natural thing because they end up drowning territory that was
right.
Once, and you may not remember this, but back, I think it was in the late 90s, but I'd have to look it up. Both Reginald Hill and Peter Robinson each wrote a terrific mystery, both of them about a reservoir and a sunken village in Yorkshire. And, you know, there's always the possibility that the village, they're concealed. In fact, that happened in there was a book in New Orleans after Katrina where
right.
The same thing came up, where a body, you know, gets concealed. And then all the water comes in and it takes...
Well, Deliverance.
Yes, I mean, exactly. Yeah, and so, you know, I think reservoirs are a natural place. But what makes your book outstanding, you know, is the suicide of the grandmother that kicks it off. Talk about unexpected. Good heavens.
Yeah. It took me a while to find that entry point, too. That was probably a third draft edition because I never felt like I had the right entry from past to present. I didn't have that bridge of eras, and I realized it was a story about sacrifice and also about the stories we tell one another and how hard it is to push back against that.
And families.
And families, exactly. Yeah, I think it's particularly challenging when it's family. So I wanted to come in with a scene that immediately evoked the Gothic and hopefully makes you turn pages. So if you think it achieved that, then...
I do. I've given it a big recommendation. No, I thought it was
thanks.
A very dramatic book, and, you know, and you've always written wonderful prose, and it helps a lot that, you know, you are
thanks.
An elegant storyteller, so whatever story you tell is shaped in part by your really excellent command of English, you know. You could somebody with lesser talent could write this book, and it wouldn't work nearly so well.
Ah, okay. That means the world to me, as you know that it will, because it's... I feel like it's the thing that writers, maybe we talk about it enough, but it doesn't come up in conversations like this. It doesn't come up in media conversations. And that is just the idea of you need to be in love with the language and the words and the structure of the sentence as well as the structure of the story. So, yeah, that means the world to me. Thank you.
Well, that's one of the things I've always liked about you. That's why you have been one of our writers in residence and why I have managed to get you here for practically all of your books, you know, because it's always such a pleasure to talk to you about your writing. So tell me, you have not only split your name, but you split your publishers. So you're still writing your crime novels over with Mulholland, but Atria picked up, is it a one or two book contract with Scott Curzon?
The first contract was two books, so yep, I'm with Atria for the Scott Carson. I hope to hope to be there a long time. They've been great. And then Little Brown, I'm on, what, 9 books with them now. Mm-hmm. So that relationship has been, it's rare at this point in publishing to have that sort of continuity.
But
yeah, I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, I think you have been too, but I also think they both seem to be comfortable with the idea that you've split your identity.
Yes, it doesn't seem to bother anyone. And that's been something that I'm sure you would anticipate I was uneasy about. You know, would I be creating any sort of rift or upsetting people by attempting to do this? And
well, I think if you'd done it as Michael Carita, you would have. But I think by changing your name, you've also, you know, there's always the potential for a Little Brown that Scott Carson will be a big success, and then that will reflect back into sales for Michael Carita, since it's not a secret who you
right.
are. And your success writing as Michael Carita, you know, adds a certain audience and luster to you as Scott Carson.
Yeah, so, ideally the right hand feeds the left. And
so back to your original question, do I think it was a good idea? And the answer is yes, but it's a good thing that everybody else thinks it's a good idea. Since try as I might to rule the publishing world, I only get to have a
well,
very small part of it.
Well, I keep nominating you. Thought you would be czar by now.
It's been wonderful talking to you, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm looking forward
to
our event this evening.